Hey, it's Francis. Thank you so much for making the Splendid Table part of your life all year long. This public media podcast is only possible because of you. You generously welcome us into your kitchens, and we do our best to provide support and inspiration along the way. So please, donate before Memorial Day weekend to support our show. Go to splendidtable.org/donate, and thank you. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table from APM. So, I was reading this fascinating article the other day by Mariana Giusti in the Financial Times about an Italian academic named Alberto Grandi. He's a professor at the University of Parma, and, well, the article starts off with Grandi being interviewed over dinner at a restaurant, and he looks around like he's, like, hiding from the cops or something, and he goes, "They hate me here." And the reason why first it's not clear who they is, and eventually you realize that they is, like, every living person in Italy. The reason why they hate him is that he has made it his life's work to poke holes in Italy's historic foods. Like how Parmesan Reggiano, right, the king of cheeses, or at least the dry, hard version that we fetishize now, was really only kind of invented in the 1960s. And what really gets people riled up is when he claims that the cheese that's closest today to the historic Parmesan is a Parmesan that's made in Wisconsin. Anyway, this dude is fascinating, but the whole reason why he makes people mad is that he's telling millions of people that the foods they think of as their cultural touchstones, you know, the thing that's always been there, their national dishes, are basically myths that were made up in the last 60 years or so. And that makes me wonder, well, what's the deal with national dishes? Or just foods that people associate with a country or a place? How do those foods become such a part of people's identities and cultures? And what happens if people try to challenge them? Well, that's all the subject of a terrific new book by Anya von Bremzen. Anya is one of the great food writers of our era, an incredibly smart and curious, globe-trotting friend of both the most famous chefs in the world and the most down-to-earth street vendor. Her new book is called National Dish. It's a journey all over the world searching for how, in some ways, it's not the people who make the dish, it's the dish who make a people. So hey, Anya, it's great to see you.
Hey, Francis. Great to see you too.
I am so happy to get to talk with you. The book is so interesting. And there's sort of an easy way to describe your book to people, right? It's like, oh, it's this book where the author goes around the world to find out the history of all these national dishes from these different countries. But really, the book is only part about that and much more about, I think, the idea of, well, what is a national dish? And who decides what a national dish is? And surprisingly, they're not always these ancient traditions, you know, that have been passed down for millennia. There are always bigger picture questions about identity and how identity even works. So let's just start all the way back in the beginning. How did you get interested in this topic? And what was the first national dish that came to your mind when you started planning it?
Well, the topic has been in my mind for so long because my first cookbook, Please to the Table, what came out in 1990 was about the cuisines of the empire called the USSR, where I grew up. And empires are multicultural. So the Soviet cuisine meant Georgian, Armenian, Uzbek. And this is a story I want to tell in my book. And it turns out it was kind of an imperialist story. And as the book went to print, the empire went bust. So people were joking, oh, why don't you turn your book into a tariff calendar? Because here's Estonia separated and Ukraine separated. Kazakhstan is out. But it's really got me thinking of how some, you know, places that are part of a country are no longer part of the country and they're independent nations. And going back to these post-Soviet spaces over the next 20 years, you kind of saw this nation-building process happening live. And that was really fascinating. And it got me thinking that, you know, they had a different canon, food canon. And now they want to kind of get rid of this colonial thinking and colonial yoke. There's something else. They're going back to pre-Soviet times. At the same time, Yugoslavia is separated. When you think about nations, they are so not old. We kind of think, oh, France always existed and always people always speak French, spoke French and ate French food. Well, at the time of the French Revolution, which was really like the created the first serious nation with self-determination and the common law and common language. Well, at the time of French Revolution in 1789, less than 25% of people spoke French or understood French. Think about
really?
Italy. Yeah, think about Italy. 1860s is when Italy starts becoming a nation from this hodgepodge right. of duchies and principalities. How many people, what percentage of the people you think speaks standard Italian in 1860s? Less than 10%. So all these people who immigrate are speaking Calabrian, Romagnolo,
Sicilian,
all these different dialects. And it's the same with cuisine. Like the whole idea of a national cuisine is something very recent and extremely constructed. And how it is constructed is exactly what I set out to investigate in National Dish.
Yeah. And so you start the story in France, as you mentioned. I think particularly, you know, in the West, there is this idea of French cuisine as being sort of this like cuisine, right? Like I went to culinary school in New York State. And what did they teach us? They taught us that the French kitchen was the basis, right? That was the foundation. All of the terms we learned were French. They taught me how to cook Chinese food through French terms. Like, you know, there is this idea that like, oh, French cuisine is sort of like the mother cuisine in the West. And obviously that's sort of absurd on its face, but there's a reason why there people feel that way. And there's a reason why that holds. So you begin the story in France. And I kind of love that the very first, maybe even the very first page of the book, you're like, yeah, I don't really like the food in Paris. I never have. You're also like the most worldly traveler and eater I know. And you're like, yeah, I'm not so into it. So why is that?
Why am I not into it? Or why did I have to start in Paris?
Well, yeah, both, I guess. Yeah.
I think they're related. Actually, the reason I'm not into it is because the France created this overbearing narrative about its supremacy, about, you know, as you just said, its sauces, its chefs, its cuisine being the greatest ever. And that's also the reason, you know, that's one reason why a lot of people don't like it, because it's just like, oh, come on, really, stop talking like that. But it's also a really important step in creating the whole idea of a national cuisine. And arguably, France did it first. France became a nation after the revolution with, you know, again, a common language, common laws, a constitution in the name of equal citizen with this, you know, liberté, égalité, fraternité, idealistic banner. And so many nations in the 19th century followed its example to fashion themselves into nations from being part of an empire or being some absolutist horrible kingdom where religion ruled. So France applied the idea of the nation and very quickly in the 19th century it started articulating the idea that its cuisine was part of its great nationhood and its supremacy. Because again, you know, 19th century, no one really talks about cuisine in that way. Because before a certain point, aristocratic cuisines of different courts, believe it or not, they were fairly globalized. There was all this, you know, Renaissance cuisine, all these spices that came from somewhere else that signified power and wealth, all these huge set pieces, like roasted peacocks and these huge pies and like all this kind of, again, you know, a show of ostentation. Same in Renaissance Italy, same in France, even in Islamic parts of Islamic world, very similar cuisines. Well, the peasants were eating gruels. And weeds and peasants,
could,
really, yeah. And you know, I mean, the whole idea that they were eating bœuf bourguignon or pot-à-feu or something really yummy, no, they didn't. So France in the 19th century creates this conversation about cuisine as being part of its soft power. And this one particular chef that I look at, Marie-Antoine Carême, he becomes this great diplomatic asset. He cooks, you know, French meals all over the world. Every noble family wants to have him as chef. You know, Napoleon adores him. He writes a cookbook where a lot of the stuff gets codified. Because how does a recipe become national, right? How does a recipe become known? You have to have it written down. And the standard language, a standard language is part of becoming a nation, as many historians argue, because as long as you have all these different dialects, what's a nation, right? It's an empire or it's whatever. But so, you know, writing in French, in standard French, standardizing the recipes, going gassing on and on and on and on about how great your cuisine is, this is what France did. Except now, as I discover, when I go to Paris and try to investigate pot-à-feu, which is this rich soupy stew of different meats and vegetables, what France considers its national dish, I discovered that nobody cares. That suddenly it's a globalized city like everything else, like New York, like London. People, you know, I try to interview people about, oh, tell me about pot-au-feu. And they're like, oh, can I tell you about this great bao ban I just had? And oh, by the way, the chocolate babka is a biggest trend. Oh, have you been to this mezcal bar? So like this global Brooklyn community, you know, finally reaches France. And to me, it's incredibly refreshing. I'm like, oh, suddenly I don't hate Paris anymore. I can actually live in this place. Yeah, you can get a mezcal and no one gives a hoot about the French national dish. But it leaves the question, okay, where do we go from there? If the world is so globalized, what happens to the idea of a national cuisine?
Right. Okay, so let's dig into the pot-au-feu for a minute. You had this really interesting moment in your book where, you know, you were trying to, you know, you were actually struggling to get someone to give you, you know, the pot-au-feu. Like, what is the platonic ideal of pot-au-feu, right? First, can you describe that dish to us or what you understand it to be, and then what it was like even shopping for it?
Yeah, it's basically a boiled dinner. That's just not, you know, without the fancy name.
It sounds less sexy. Boiled dinner.
Pot on a fire. So it's a boiled dinner that has different cuts of meat, sometimes chicken, to which you add vegetables. And the really crucial part is a bouillon, because for France, you know, the broth is something very essential. Stock is like the foundation of all the sauces. Sure. It's really like the liquid building block. And Escoffier, Carême, all these chefs, you know, gas on and on about how stock is so important. So it combines all these different elements. And people will tell you different ideas about what cuts of beef. But again, it's very funny. I go to like this French butchers and they're like, oh, would you like this, you know, to make your Mexican fajita? You know, I've got this great, great cut of beef. So in the end, the only person who really cares about pot-au-feu is this Moroccan butcher in this multi-ethnic neighborhood, the 13th where I'm staying. And I have this like amazing moment of revelation, because he has all these Moroccan people speaking Berber, French, Arabic, and they're all bashing Paris. You know, it's just like Paris is a horrible place. You know, they really don't respect immigrants. They're trying to make us eat ham, blah, 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 blah. You know, so like there's this moment like where I feel, okay, I'm an immigrant too, you know. And then I tell them, oh, I have to make pot-au-feu from this 19th century cookbook. And the guy, Monsieur Larbi, gets really serious. And he said, oh, here's this cut and here's this cut. And, you know, he just doesn't even ask me what I need. He kind of slaps it on the scale. He weighs it and he just hands it to me and said, c'est un vrai pot-au-feu. This is how you make the real pot-au-feu. I said, but Mr. Larbi, I have a slightly different recipe. And they look at me like I'm this intruder. I don't know, you know, anything about France. And even this Madame Fatima, this Berber lady with like a handful of sheep's brains that she's buying. She said, no. She said, oh, vrai pot-au-feu. So all these like people are lecturing me about what a real pot-au-feu is. And I'm just going, oh my God, identity. It's just so fluid and so transactional. Right. Here are people that were bashing Paris 2 minutes ago, suddenly are defending their culinary and national patrimony. And it just, that moment really stayed with me. Yeah. We think identities are fixed. No, they change.
Right. Anya von Bremzen is the author of National Dish, Around the World in Search of Food, History, and the Meaning of Home. We'll be back with more with Anya in a minute. I'm Francis Lam, and this is The Splendid Table from APM. Our show is supported by Hero Bread. You know, for a lot of us, bread has been a staple all our lives. Toast at breakfast, sandwiches at lunch, a nice buttered roll at dinner. It's comforting and delicious, and bread is often what we crave, but sometimes it can sit a little heavy after a meal. That's where Hero Bread comes in. They've created fluffy, delicious versions of the breads that we're used to, but that include no net carbs, 0 grams of sugar, and fewer calories. Oh, and there's more good stuff too, like protein and fiber. Hero Bread has everything from your daily sandwich loaf to tortillas or hot dog and hamburger buns. The products are flavorful and they have something for every craving, from a dressed-up breakfast burrito to a late-night PB&J. They even have monthly small-batch drops of indulgent treats like 2-gram net-carb Hero Croissant or the 1-gram net-carb Hero Cheddar Biscuit. Don't give up being a breadhead. Hero Bread is offering 10% off your order. Go to hero.co and use code TABLE at checkout. That's TABLE at hero.co.
I want to tell you about a new podcast called Amuse News. Publishing multiple days a week, Amuse News is your source for food news, interviews from around the food world, and more. On the show, we'll be engaging with food storytellers, from chefs to advocates to people working in the field and many more. Find Amuse News wherever you get your podcasts. Amuse News is a destination for everyone who's looking for a new, insightful look into the world of food.
I'm Francis Lamb, and this is the show for curious cooks and eaters. We're digging deep today into national dishes and what it means to have certain foods that have that kind of mythology. Let's get back to it with Anya von Bremzen, author of the book National Dish. There's already a lot of complexity here, right? Because you're talking about how France, sort of as a nation, as an idea, presented its cuisine as being part of its nationhood.
Mm-hmm.
What made it special, what made it unique, and, you know, convince the rest of the world that, like, our cuisine is, in fact, the greatest cuisine, and you should base everything on us, and yada, yada, yada. The next chapter in your book, you go to Naples, from Paris and Naples, and, you know, so now you're in Italy, and you're talking about pizza and pasta pomodoro. You know, the idea that pizza and pasta pomodoro as the national dishes of Italy, I don't think I know many people who would argue against that, but your theory, though, is that that idea didn't actually come from Italians themselves, or at least not people in Italy. Tell us about that.
That was really a fascinating twist as well, because also we should mention that, let's say, you know, in the 19th century, France was exporting professional chefs and sauces and the sense of a supremacy. What was Italy exporting into the world at the end of the 19th century? Hungry peasants who were fleeing the poverty and the chaos and this brutal taxation that's taking place after the unification of the country. Because these processes are very painful of creating a nation. And
sure.
Italy has one of, if not the largest, recorded out-migration in history of any country. Because we associate Italy with good food. But in fact, these people fled because they had no food.
Mm.
Again, despite our stereotypes of like this idealized peasant cuisine, they were eating acqua sale, which is like this dark gruel, you know, the dark bread dipped in vinegar and hardly anything else. So these people are, a lot of them are from the south. They have no unified identity. They're Calabrians or Sicilians or Neapolitans. But they settled in the Americas, in North and in South America.
Mm-hmm.
And they learn to speak to each other. And they have to speak to each other in common Italian. They're reading Italian newspapers published by Italy in the newly standardized Florentine Italian. So they become Italians before that process happens outside of Italy. And the cuisine also, they're kind of mixing, right? There's a cotoletta alla milanese, the, you know, the breaded cutlet, which is from the north, and maybe some greens, which are, you know, let's say Sicilian, and the cassata or spumone, which is also Sicilian, and all the tomato sauce dishes, pizza, pasta, which are associated with Naples. And they interact with each other much more than this happens back in Italy. And so arguably, I mean, it's one theory, that the Italian cuisine gets unified and becomes Italian in diaspora before that process starts happening back in the Bel Paese.
Yeah. You know, and then when I think about the arc of Italian cuisine in the United States, right, of course it starts with the early immigrants who did settle, you know, in along the Eastern Seaboard, right? New York City, obviously, New Jersey, you know, famously, Boston, you know, all the way up New England. And we think of the cuisine of those communities, we call them like, oh, red sauce joints now, right? Like sometimes we call it red sauce sort of pejoratively, sometimes, you know, with a hint of nostalgia. It's like an old idea of Italian food because sometime in the 80s, Northern Italian food became fashionable, right? And oh my God, Italian food without tomatoes.
Sure.
And things like, you know, Milanese and things like risotto and, you know, things that were sold as being more refined. And now all of a sudden we felt, again, as Americans, that we had this more sophisticated knowledge of Italian food. You know, we're starting the idea of regionality, even though we're not actually getting into the regions. But we still think we know what Italian food is, right? And we still think we know that it's pizza and it's pasta. And now you're in Naples and you're talking to these extremely sophisticated, dedicated, detailed, you know, master craftspeople of pizza who will tell you it's like the greatest pursuit on earth, but will also tell you that, hey, pizza was not exactly the pride of Italy. And, you know, we remember when people looked down on us for eating pizza. And in fact, there's this thing called the pizza effect. Tell us about the pizza effect.
Yes. Well, to start with, you know, what thing that startled me really is how denigrated pizza was by Northern Italians and how unknown it was outside of the South, to the point where in the early 20th century, when writers wrote about pizza, they had to explain it to the Northerners. And then you have someone like Carlo Collodi, who created Pinocchio, and he wrote a book.
Like the story of Pinocchio.
Yeah, he wrote a school book for Italian school children about this little boy who goes around Italy. And he said, should I explain to you what pizza is? It resembles complicated filth. So yeah, that was just like this racially tainted slurs of the South generally, like Naples can always compare to Africa. Oh, so Africani. A complete kind of lack of understanding what pizza was, because pizza was the food of the poor. Another factoid that just kind of struck with me, 19th century Naples had 10 times the urban density of Victorian London, which was already pretty overcrowded.
Oh, wow.
So pizza was just like poor people's cheap, you know, food that cost one saldo, that provided decent nutrition, and, you know, that was delivered because people lived kind of half on the street. So here you have something that's scorned, misrepresented, but gets valorized abroad. Right?
Yeah, people fall in love with it outside of the country, yeah.
Yeah, and it gets sort of reinfused and repatriates back to Naples, imbued with a new sense of pride. And this is a pizza effect. The term pizza effect was coined by a Hindu scholar, and it actually described yoga. Because yoga was like no big deal in India, apparently, and then it really took off abroad, and then was re-imported back to India, but now with kind of a new meaning and a new sense of pride around it. Which is kind of what happens with pizza.
That's so interesting. How did pizza then become, I mean, when it was re-imported back into Italy, how did the Northerners, the non-pizza eaters, shake off their biases against pizza?
Arguably, some historians argue that pizza didn't really take off in Italy until like the 80s and 90s.
Like the 1980s and 90s.
Yeah, right. Pizza at one point becomes very famous beach food. So you go to the beach, you have your pizza. As one of the historians explained to me, it was like a Saturday thing. But then the recession hits. And the 90s are a really important decade in like all the cuisines that I've discovered, because on the one hand, you are rediscovering this globalization, it's encroaching, neoliberal economies. So people suddenly get nostalgic. And that's when regional food comes in. That's when people are talking about roots and nostalgia. And pizza is a perfect example because it costs a few euros. It's still very cheap. And it went from being a Saturday thing to what the Italians call pasto completo, like a full meal. Families would go to a pizzeria and have a meal, and it wouldn't be so expensive. So you're really talking, 80s, 90s, when pizza becomes like this totally Italian thing. And now you have northern cities overtaking Naples in pizza. Naples is like in eighth place or even something like this, you know, because they're kind of wanting burger, un hamburger. They're, you know, rediscovering the world. And meanwhile, the northern Italians are completely hooked.
That's so interesting. And this actually reminds me, a similar effect, but maybe in the opposite direction, with the corn tortilla. There's another chapter in the book where you're in Mexico, specifically in Oaxaca. And, you know, especially right now in this moment in the U.S., among, you know, chefs, high-end chefs, there's this obsession with heirloom corn from Mexico, typically from Oaxaca. And, like, corn tortillas have become this sort of symbol of authenticity, this symbol of, like, beautiful indigenous foods. But in Mexico, the corn tortilla, even though it's been like the staff of life for, in this case, truly thousands of years, wasn't actually respected in the same way. And people were pushing flour tortillas.
Not necessarily the flour tortilla, is actually bread. It's kind of astounding to see what disrespect and oppression and kind of almost persecution the maize culture faced in Mexico from the onset, from the start of colonizations, because, you know, the colonists, the Spaniards come, they bring with them wheat. Wheat is really important to them, not just as a crop, as an economic force, but it's important Christian symbol, right? You have bread, Holy Communion. Mm-hmm. So bread, wine, olive oil become, you know, the sort of instruments of conversion. of indigenous population to Christianity. And they're basically pushing bread for centuries. Even after the Mexican Revolution of 1910, which was in the name of the campesinos, the peasants, which regulated the tortilla prices, which protected the economy and maize productions. But the ideologues of the revolution are still pushing wheat. Or they're thinking, oh, maybe we should try growing soybeans. So this association of completely racialized association of maize with indigeneity, with primitivity, so quote-unquote, with poverty, and wheat with acculturation of the indigenous population into the white European Spanish-inflected culture. And this goes on, and by the middle of the 20th century, I think bread is overtaking maize products in consumption. So Mexicans are eating a lot of bread. And it is only really, as I discovered with NAFTA, U.S. is flooding Mexico with industrial corn, mainly for feed. And there's this fear of GMO contamination. And again, this is happening in the 90s with all these grassroots movements that I mentioned before all over the world to protect heritage. And then there's this massive grassroots movement to protect Mexicanness, to protect Mexican identity, to elevate maize, corn, into something of a national symbol officially. So that acknowledgement of the importance of maize is really recent. And to be honest, the campesinos, the farmers, are still really struggling to make ends meet because there's this onslaught of horrible industrialized agriculture in the north of the country, the industrial farming of maize. But it's a difficult situation because, as I discover, for the women who make the tortillas that are so idealized, it's a brutal, brutal labor. So part of my Mexico, my Oaxaca chapter, I go around asking women, is tortilla esclavitud, slavery, or empoderamiento, or empowerment? And the answers are really surprising because there's so many health issues, for instance, from smoke inhalation, from kneeling. So I'm asking, what is it worth to preserve the tortilla and to preserve this heirloom agriculture in a changing world for these people?
That's so interesting.
And the problem is with this kind of idealization of heirloom corn, heirloom maize, and with the demand for this special masa, there's really a threat that the campesinos, the farmers, are not going to have enough for themselves. So suddenly all the yuppie people at every restaurant in New York want this variety of maize. It's a real issue.
That's interesting. That's exactly the same thing that happened with quinoa, happens with acai. Well, that's all very depressing.
Well, I think we can do things. I mean, I think all these talks about politics, about cultural appropriation, about native agriculture, they are important conversations, and we're having them now. But I always joke that there, you know, for every time we talk about cultural appropriation, if there was a donate button, and if something, you know, like led to actual political action, if there was more awareness, and if we knew exactly how to help and how we should be behaving, as opposed to just practicing another form of consumerism. Okay, because ethical consumerism is still consumerism, and it doesn't resolve world issues, right? So in ways, much of my book is about these conversations that are not always comfortable, but are hugely interesting, and I felt, you know, important.
Yeah. Well, let's get to the last part of the book then. I think you write it as an epilogue. It's not technically a final chapter, but the very last section of the book starts in February 2022 when Russia begins its full-scale invasion of Ukraine. And you talk about how, you know, growing up in Moscow, in Soviet Moscow, as you did before you came to the United States, you grew up with borscht as a soup that was in your home, as a soup your mother cooked. It was part of your life. And now you write about how, in a sense, you feel like you should give it up. Talk about that.
That was a very difficult chapter to write, or epilogue. Originally, I was hoping to do an epilogue on Thanksgiving in my multicultural neighborhood of Jackson Heights, Queens, to bring it home to something American and to see what this sort of invented tradition meant for different people. And literally, as I was thinking about it, the war broke out. And as it happened, Putin made his full-scale invasion of Ukraine in a war that started, don't forget, in 2014 with the invasion of eastern Ukraine. And I have a pot of my mother's borscht that is sitting in my fridge. And suddenly, I mean, it's almost like tainted with blood for me because, like, here's, you know, Putin's attempt to just completely obliterate this country. Borscht is something that's eaten in Poland, in Lithuania, in Moldova. Ukraine means border, so there was, you know, a lot of mixing when it was part of the Russian. First, it was part of Lithuanian, Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth, then part of the Russian Empire, then part of the Soviet Empire. And as I said before, when you have an empire, it's almost like a metaphor that everybody eats everybody else's food. It is multicultural. Mm-hmm. And for so many Russians, for generations, borscht was part of their own, if not national heritage, it was part of their own diet. It was just a hugely popular soup. Everybody's mother and grandmother made it. My mom, as it happens, was born in Odessa.
In Ukraine.
But in a Jewish, Russian-speaking family, and now we considered ourselves Russian-Jewish Americans who emigrated. But borscht was such an intimate part of my own history. My own history as a Russian-speaking person who grew up in Moscow. Suddenly, 5 years of research that I've been doing on National Dish, talking about how you define heritage, who owns what, who can own a recipe, suddenly it's landing on my own table with just this searingly visceral intensity. And it's kind of trivial to think about soup when the war is happening, but it's, you know, food is a very deep way of expressing a culture. And in this chapter, I sort of go into this whole history of borscht and how Ukraine turned it into a symbol of resistance. Because Russians have been goading them since 2019 and tweets, the Russian Minister of Culture, oh, borscht is a Russian soup and it's ours and like blah, blah, blah. And so Ukrainians were just really livid about this. Again, on institutional level and on just grassroots level. And finally, they appealed for it to be included as a Ukrainian dish on UNESCO's cultural heritage, intangible heritage list, which they were awarded almost 1 year after the war. So that was kind of a bittersweet. But I write about how symbolically important a dish can be to a nation, especially at the time of strife. But I also write about how, again, something I talked about with Paris, how identities can shift overnight. Suddenly, I woke up the next day and saying, I don't want to be Russian. I want to have nothing to do with this country. I felt embarrassed for thinking in Russian, for the volumes of Dostoevsky and Tolstoy on my shelf. And I said to myself, how can I decolonize myself? How can I stop my own imperial thinking in regards to Ukraine? And I started researching borscht in Ukrainian. Which is not a language I understood immediately, but I kind of learned it eventually. And just seeing it from completely Ukrainian perspective, trying to erase, which is what Ukrainians try to do, its, you know, colonized history and its imperialist history as part of the Soviet or Russian Empire. And just looking at what incredible symbolic significance it has for Ukrainians now. I mean, literally, when the soldiers come back to their families, it's the first thing that they eat. They serve it for funerals. They serve it for celebrations. As one Ukrainian scholar told me, it's red like our blood. And it became a line of separation. The Russians used to say, oh, the cutesy, folksy Ukrainians, you know, with their borscht. But now, actually, borscht is ours. She said, no, this is when we say no to colonialism. And it was very, very powerful. And the book ends with me cooking all these different borscht versions that I've never cooked before for a couple of Ukrainian friends who I thought would not want to speak to me after the war because we're Russians. But they came, and it was really cathartic to eat borscht together. And then I asked, you know, will Russians and Ukrainians ever eat borscht together again, you know, in that territory? And the answer, many generations will pass. You know, the Ukrainians who win this war and Russians who lose this war, you know, that their children maybe can talk and share a dish. So we have this benevolent idea that sharing food will end wars and end conflicts. And it's a very powerful mantra and something to be believed in, but it's not always the case. I mean, will Israelis and Palestinians ever share hummus? I mean, they're trying, but I mean, the way we talk about food is often a proxy for talking about larger conflicts. And these conflicts are real, and they won't necessarily resolve when people share a dish. What do you think?
I think that's absolutely right. And I think that, you know, there is this Pollyanna-ish idea of like, oh, let's just share a meal and everything will get worked out. Nothing happens like that. What we need is people to really understand what it means to come to a table and what that means of, in some ways, we have to sort of let go of ourselves and let go of what we mean and what we think we mean if we really want to connect with someone else. And like you said, Borscht is a part of your past, it's a part of your history, in some ways part of your identity, and for you to actively try to see it from someone else's point of view and say, no, this is yours, and I have to be okay with that. I think that has to be part of any true coming together. Well, thank you so much, Anya. Just really love talking with you.
Thanks so much. It was a wonderful conversation.
Anya von Bremzen is the author of National Dish, Around the World in Search of Food, History, and the Meaning of Home. You can find her mom's recipe for her super quick vegetarian borscht at splendidtable.org. Coming up, not Argentina's national dish, but their national drink, mate, with Tomy Martín Sánchez. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table from APM. Our show is supported by Hero Bread. You know, for a lot of us, bread has been a staple all our lives. Toast at breakfast, sandwiches at lunch, a nice buttered roll at dinner. It's comforting and delicious, and bread is often what we crave. But sometimes, it can sit a little heavy after a meal. That's where Hero Bread comes in. They've created fluffy, delicious versions of the breads that we're used to, but that include no net carbs, 0 grams of sugar, and fewer calories. Oh, and there's more good stuff too, like protein and fiber. Hero Bread has everything from your daily sandwich loaf to tortillas or hot dog and hamburger buns. The products are flavorful and they have something for every craving, from a dressed-up breakfast burrito to a late-night PB&J. They even have monthly small-batch drops of indulgent treats like 2-gram net-carb Hero Croissant or the 1-gram net-carb Hero Cheddar Biscuit. Don't give up being a breadhead. Hero Bread is offering 10% off your order. Go to hero.co and use code TABLE at checkout. That's table at hero.co. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is the show for curious cooks and eaters. So now we're going from a discussion about national dishes to one about a national drink. Argentina is, of course, world famous for its wines, but its national drink is not a wine, it's a tea. Or an infusion, to be more precise, because it's made with an herb, not literal tea leaves. I'm talking about mate, and Tomás Martín Sánchez is a mate sommelier at the Buenos Aires-based Mate & Company, and he's here to tell us all about this beautifully buzzy drink. Hola, Tomy. Thanks so much for coming by.
Hola, Francis. How are you? Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So congratulations to you for winning the World Cup last year. Just seeing all the videos of the celebrations, and like, it really looked like the entire country was just going out of their minds.
It was wild, and, yeah.
Yeah, it was so amazing that Lionel Messi gets to have that trophy in his trophy case. But I have to tell you, afterwards, I saw like the funniest article online. The headline was Yerba Mate the reason for Messi's success?
Yes, we all saw it. It's interesting, and football is probably one of the reasons why mate is becoming more well-known in the world. So yeah, definitely had a lot to do with us winning the World Cup.
Yeah, it was all the mate. So tell us, what is yerba mate?
Actually, mate is a tree. It's the yerba mate tree that grows in the north of Argentina and in the south of Brazil and in Paraguay. That's the region where the tree grows. So we use the leaf from the tree. There's a production process, of course. There's a drying process, a natural aging process, a grinding process. But it's basically that. It's a tree. It's originally from Argentina. It is an ancient tradition for us. The natives discovered it thousands of years ago. Those were the ones that started it. And we've been drinking it for thousands and thousands of years. And it is super, super popular. It is our national infusion. We drink more mate than coffee, more mate than tea. But actually, the Argentine people drink statistically more mate than water, than regular water.
How is that possible?
It's like twice more mate than water. We drink 100 liters per person per year of mate average.
That is incredible.
And as you, Francis, were saying, football players use it a lot, and people that do sports in general, because it's energizing, because it has caffeine, but it's energizing in a healthier way than coffee, because of the way you drink it. You drink small sips in a longer period of time, so the effect is not aggressive as coffee, and it's antioxidant and has minerals, vitamins. So that's why Messi used it, and all the other players from his team used it as well. And that's also one of the reasons why it's becoming more well-known.
Okay, well, let's start with, what's it taste like? I've tried it before, and I remember thinking it was very bitter, but sort of in a pleasant way. So how would you describe the flavor of it?
It's bitter, definitely more bitter than tea. It has a lot of similarities in terms of the flavor with matcha, with green tea, you know, those strong herbal flavors. But yeah. Mate is actually a little bit more bitter than that. It is definitely an acquired taste, even for us. People here in Argentina drink mate from a very early age. We have a tea version of it that comes in a tea bag. We call it mate cocido in Spanish, but it's basically ground mate in a tea bag. And we usually, as young kids, we start with that version just to get used to the intensity and to the flavor. And then at some point, when you are sort of ready to go for the real thing, you start with the traditional. But it's definitely bitter, strong, very herbal. It has a very interesting bitterness.
Yeah. You know, millions of people drink coffee. Billions of people drink coffee. But, you know, we don't think of it as a bitter flavor. Or billions of people eat chocolate, but we don't think of it as a bitter flavor because we're just so accustomed to it. So I think we have this association sometimes when we say the word bitter, that bitter means bad. But really, like you said, it's just another flavor. It's just another taste that you can acquire. And I think the bitterness of mate, in my experience, and I'm not very experienced in it at all, it has a bitterness, but also like a very sort of like a beautiful kind of like ringing bitterness, not like a heavy, like make your face go like, ugh.
Definitely.
You know, it just sort of like, it sort of like stimulates.
Yeah. It definitely lifts you up and it really hits you in the best way possible. Mm. And people also use it a lot as an alternative to coffee here. People that have issues with caffeine or that drink a lot of coffee, maybe you drink your coffee in the morning, but then you go for mate all day long. Like in coffee, you drink all the caffeine concentrated in one cup. So that's why you get the shock of energy and then you go down super quick. With mate, it's the complete opposite because you have small portions of water. You get to drink from the same cup for 1, 2, 3 hours. So you take the caffeine slowly, portion by portion. And that's why the effect is longer because you get to drink from it for a longer time, but way less intense and not aggressive at all.
So, okay, you're saying you drink a little bit at a time over a long period of time. That kind of goes to the particular way that it's drunk, right? Like it is a very, I don't know if ritual is the right word, but my understanding is you just don't make a cup of it, you know, drink it down and you keep going with your day. It is something you really enjoy through the day. People carry it with them all day long.
Yeah.
Tell us about that and the culture of it.
It is a companion for us, definitely. It's not just a drink. As you said, it's definitely a ritual for us. Actually, traditionally, and especially pre-pandemic, pre-COVID, it was a ritual of sharing. So you would find all the people here sharing it with groups of family or groups of friends or different groups of people that you got together with. After COVID, the ritual changed a little bit. So now you're going to find some people that share it maybe with their closer friends or their closer family, maybe not with complete strangers anymore, which was what we did pre-COVID, just shared it with whoever was there.
Wait, when you say share it, you mean literally share from the same cup?
Literally, right? Share from the same cup, the same straw, passing germs from one person to the other. But that's exactly the way we did it, yeah. So in that way, COVID changed the ritual a lot, but it is a ritual. You need a specific cup, a specific straw that are just made for mate. We don't use regular mugs or regular cups. We use the specific mate cups and the specific straws. We call them bombillas, our straws, our metal straws that we use for it. And you basically pour the leaves in the cup, then pour the hot water. The hot water is going to be between 75 to 80 degrees Celsius. So it's not boiling water, but it's hot water. And you pour it where the straw is, and then you sip from the straw. So it's small portions of water, small sips, and then you refill it. That is why if you go wherever you go here in Argentina, you go to a park or you're in an office or at someone's house or wherever, and you see people having mate, you're going to see them carrying the thermos under their arm. I call it the third arm, actually, that we have here, because you have to refill it all the time. So that's why we call it a companion to our other activities. If you're working, if you're studying, if you're doing whatever you're doing, you're going to have your mate cup and your thermos with you. And in that way, it's a companion, really.
And tell me about that, like sharing. You even mentioned with strangers. So like you'll be in a park with friends and you'll be like, oh, hey, you come over here. Have some. Oh, do you want some mate with us? Or what's that like?
Exactly. That's
social.
That's exactly how it worked. Yeah. Well, you would be at a park or by the riverside, or if you travel wherever you were, and you were with your group of friends, maybe having it, passing it on from hand to hand. That's the way we share it. We sit in a circle and pass it on from hand to hand. And we all drink from the same cup and the same straw. But maybe a complete stranger would come out of a rock and be like, hey guys, do you mind if I join your round and have some mate with you? And you would actually meet people. You would bond with people over mate. You would make like mate friends, I always say. Or you would be alone wherever and you would have a group of people that you see that are having it, and you would be like, hey guys, do you mind if I join you and have some mate with you? And you're never going to refuse, you're never going to deny a mate cup to someone. It's something that I always say that even for people that don't particularly like the flavor here, because it's a strong flavor, it's a bitter flavor. So you have some people that maybe wouldn't make it for themselves. But it's something mm-hmm. that if you're in a group, if you're with your friends and people start having it, you're going to have it anyways, you know, just out of the social pressure, or you're going to have it in your house just in case someone comes over. And that's why it's so massive too, and why consumption levels are so high, because it's something that really everyone drinks.
That's incredible. Do you have like friends that you have made? Like, oh yeah, I met that person like, because where I was like sitting around once and like they came over and joined us for mate.
Definitely, definitely. I make mate friends all the time, all the time. Or like mate is the purpose of our meetings most of the time. So I would be, I don't know, in my house on a Saturday evening bored without anything to do. And I would text my friends and be like, hey guys, let's hang out and have some mate. So they come to my house, or we go to a park, or we go to someone's house, and we get together to share the mate. That's the actual purpose of our meeting. And then you start talking about life or sharing experiences or whatever. But the actual purpose of us getting together is to share some mate. So in that way, it's definitely more than just a drink for us. I would say people like it more because of the communion that you have with it than because of the drink itself.
Mm, I love that. And are there like varieties, origins? Oh, this person's mate is great, or that area's mate is amazing, or that area's mate is like, oh, not so good. Like, is there a sense of that kind of like, you know, with wine, like grape varietals and regions, is there a culture of that as well? Or is it so social that people aren't picky about it?
No, I mean, people are passionate about the flavors that they like. So in that way, maybe you find a brand that you like and you are going to be loyal to the brand because people are very passionate about that. But people like to experiment a lot with mate. Because it's something that we drink 24/7. That's another difference that it has with tea and coffee. It's not occasional. It's not that we drink it in the morning or in the afternoon. We literally, I know that 24/7 sounds like an exaggeration, but it's literally 24/7. We wake up in the morning. First thing we do is put the water for the mate and then drink it all day long. Maybe you go to work and you drink it at work too. You go to school or to college, you drink it there as well. Come back home, keep on drinking it at home. So in that way, it's really something that we drink a lot. And in that way, people started experimenting with it because so that you don't drink the exact same flavor all the time. Mm-hmm, people like to add different things to it. So that's how the blend started, for example. People started adding orange peel or lemon peel or ginger or coffee or whatever ingredient, herb, fruit that they had in their kitchen or in their garden. They started putting that in the mate or in the water. You can put honey in it. You can put sugar in it. So in that way, people started to experiment a lot. Back in the day, back by the gaucho times where the mate ritual started, those were the more traditional times. It wasn't very accepted. It was a way more strict ritual. But now it is super flexible in that way. Anyone can do whatever they want to it. We have already blended brands like ours, for example, that sell already prepared combinations of mate. In our case, organic mate, 100% natural mate, very good quality mate mixed with different natural ingredients, with coffee, ginger, coconut, mint, lemon. So now you have a lot of options. If you go to a supermarket here, you're going to find tens of hundreds of brands, some super accessible, some more expensive, organic, non-organic, smoky, flavored, non-flavored. So in that way, it's there's a lot of options for the Argentine people to choose from now.
That's cool. And you'd mentioned when we talked earlier that there's also like regional differences, right? Where the mate is processed maybe differently, or maybe they use a different sort of variety of it, and the flavor is different there too.
Yeah, the flavor changes a lot depending on the country that you're at. For example, Uruguay has a lot of consumption of mate as well. Actually, Uruguay is the country that consumes it the most if you consider per person consumption. They're super crazy about it too. But their sherva, that's the name of the leaves, sherva, sherva mate, because that's the name of the tree, actually the sherva mate tree. Their sherva is very ground and very small. Their leaves are very small. They have a lot of powder in their packages. So it's very, very strong, way stronger than ours. Then if you go to Brazil, for example, Brazil, who also consumes, especially in the south, they don't dry their leaves as much as we do. So their flavor is more natural and more green and, yeah, more grassy maybe in that way. So also stronger than ours. And then you come to Argentina and here we dry the leaves, but we don't grind them a lot. So they are, it's a mixture between bigger leaves, smaller leaves, some powder, some stems. So it's more of a combination between all of the components here. So that's why our flavor is not that strong, or not as strong as the one in Uruguay or in Brazil. Or even here in Argentina, we have our production area is in Misiones and Corrientes, two of our northern provinces. So that's where we harvest the trees and where production happens. And for example, the more in the north you are, the stronger the flavor is going to be because you're closer to the rainforest. So the leaves are more resistant to different weather conditions. So the flavor is strong. So in that way, yeah, depending on the region that you're at, it changes a lot, the flavor too.
That's super interesting. And finally, this is something, as you said, like people drink all day. They literally carry their cup and they carry their hot water with them all day long. There aren't really many like mate cafes. Like you don't go to a place because everyone kind of has their own. But is this something that you would have with food as well? Is it like a beverage you would have with food?
Definitely, yes. You would definitely have it for breakfast, but you would also have it with lunch or with dinner. Also because it's digestive, it helps digestion a lot. So people here use it after meals as well. But yeah, as you said, we don't have places to go and have mate. If you come to Buenos Aires, for example, we have two coffee shops per block, but we don't have mate shops. We don't have places for people to go and have mate. I think the main reason why is because of what we talked about before, the preparation method. It's not a grab and go thing. It's not a fast thing. It's not something that you can just take and go to continue with your day. You need a space and you need time. You need a cup, a straw. You're going to have to refill it. I always say that for me, one of the best things about mate is that it's not instant, right? So you need to be present in the moment. Usually when we get together, because of how the preparation works, you would leave your cell phone away and have at least 1 or 2 hours of that authentic experience that comes from the natives, that connects us with our traditions and that is very healthy. So in that way, it's a very nice, genuine moment for us to share, which I think is the reason why my generation and the younger generations have embraced it. And mate is even more popular now than what it was by the time of the gauchos 200 or 300 years ago.
I love that. That's beautiful. Well, thank you so much, Tomi. I can't wait to come back to Buenos Aires. It's been like 5 or 6 years since I was there. So come back and share some mate with you.
Yes, please, please, please come. It's beautiful. And Buenos Aires is a beautiful city, tons of things to do. And you're going to see mate everywhere. Mate, dulce de leche, and asado. That's what I always say. That's like our starter pack. So yeah.
Terrific. Well, thank you so much.
No, please. Thank you for having me. It was a pleasure.
Tomás Martín Sánchez is the Mate Sommelier for Mate & Company. They're based in Buenos Aires, but they ship worldwide. That's our show for the week. We hope you enjoyed it, and I hope you eat or drink something legendary today. Talk to you next week. APM Studios are run by Chandra Kavati, Alex Schaffert, and Joanne Griffith. Beth Perlman's our executive producer, and The Splendid Table was created by Sally Swift and Lim Rosetto Casper. It's made every week by technical producer Jennifer Lukey, producer Erica Romero, digital producer James Napoli, and managing producer Sally Swift. Subscribe to our podcast on Spotify, Apple, or wherever you get your downloads, and take some time to leave us a review. We really want to hear what you think. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is APM Studios.
My name is Lee Hawkins. I've been a journalist for over 25 years. On my new podcast, What Happened in Alabama, I get answers to some of the hardest questions about how things came to be for many Black Americans and the truth that must come before any reconciliation can happen. I investigate my family history, my upbringing in Minnesota, and my father's painful nightmares about growing up in Alabama. What Happened in Alabama is a new series confronting the cycles of trauma for myself, my family, and for many Black Americans. Listen now.